Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today has compiled a hybrid study. It is part history of medicine, part social history, and part military and institutional history. Dylan Carroll is a history instructor at Butte College, who holds a PhD from the University of Georgia, and he wrote his dissertation on emotionally and psychologically damaged veterans of the American Civil War. In his book, Invisible Wounds, Mental Illness and Civil War Soldiers, Dylan Carroll reveals how soldiers, nurses, doctors, army brass, and civilians interpreted mental illness during the war. Dylan Carroll, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I kind of did an informal survey about people's ancestors in the Civil War because one of my ancestors fought in the Civil War, and I thought, well, that's probably pretty common. But the short survey that I did, I didn't uncover anybody, well, one other person whose ancestor fought in the Civil War. And I suspect that you don't have any family members that fought in that war. Did you?
I don't really. On my mom's side, there's an ancestor who, the story was he fought in the Civil War, but I actually did some digging and found that he served briefly for about 3 months in a brief unit in 1864. And this was kind of late enlistments where they wanted to get men, you know, to guard POW camps or guard hospitals. And so he didn't really do any kind of service. And actually, his record indicates that he went AWOL. He left without permission. On my dad's side, my direct ancestor was essentially a refugee of the Civil War. He was from Georgia and married a northerner from Indiana, oddly enough. And then they, in 1860, were in Arkansas. And the family lore is that, you know, they had a young family and someone told them, you know, there's a war coming. This is not a place for a young family. And then they were briefly in Indiana and then they moved to Missouri. And essentially, you know, I think they were, you know, refugees of sorts from the war.
So did this family connection play a role in your interest in writing and studying the Civil War?
No, it didn't actually. And I actually didn't know this until I went to grad school at the University of Georgia. And I was just, the college had a subscription to Ancestry. And so I was just, you know, sort of interested and started doing a little bit of digging and found that my dad's ancestors were from Georgia. And I was like, wow, that's pretty weird.
Yeah, there you are in Georgia.
Yeah, there I am in Georgia. And my direct ancestors on my dad's side were, you know, lived in Georgia for a time. It didn't really inspire me to do the research and the writing. It was just sort of a funny accident.
Well, your book was a personal journey for me because my connection to the Civil War, and we did not call it the Civil War. When I was growing up, if you wrote an essay, you called it the War Between the States, or other people called it the War of Northern Aggression. But my connection began before I was born. My dad proposed to my mother on Shiloh Battlefield.
Oh, wow. How romantic.
Yes, wasn't it, though? And my great-grandfather fought for the Union, even though he lived in Tennessee, which, as you know, people could join either and did join either side when they lived in Tennessee.
Yeah. And Tennessee, especially the Appalachian regions of Tennessee, had strong Union loyalty. And a place like Knoxville, Tennessee, was very pro-Union during the war, which... When I was living in the South and in school at Georgia, I always thought it was funny when I'd be driving up the Appalachians and see Confederate flags. I'd often think, you know, I bet your great, great pappy fought for the North and you just don't know.
Well, when my dad was growing up, he was saying that you could find on this battlefield, you could just go out, walk around, find mini balls and belt buckles people didn't value them, so they didn't collect them. So that was another thing that interested me, was the role that the mini ball played in the war. And what was that for people who, and I may not even be pronouncing it, that's the way I heard it pronounced.
That's how the soldiers pronounced it. They called it mini ball, but technically it was probably called mini A ball because the inventor of it, Claude Minier, invented the ball. He was a Frenchman. An American, James Burton, perfected Claude Minier's invention. And the mini ball or the mini A ball was a technological leap when it comes to ordnance. It was unlike the previous form of technology, the smoothbore musket, which used a round ball. The mini ball was conical in shape, much like a modern bullet. And so it was sort of cone-shaped, and it had three concentric rings at the bottom and a hollow base. And that meant when a gun was fired, the bullet would expand into the barrel, and rifling on the inside of the barrel would spin the bullet. And the bullet's aerodynamic shape meant that soldiers had a much greater range and accuracy firing a rifled musket with a mini ball. And so the old smoothbore musket that soldiers used in the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, even the most seasoned soldier had a range and accuracy of about 100 to 200 yards max. But the rifled musket with the mini A ball, a soldier had a range and accuracy of about 500 to 800 yards. So they could be much more accurate in their fire. And what makes the Civil War so deadly is that the technology had advanced, but the tactics had not. And so the armies were using the old Napoleonic tactics, but meanwhile, the technology had advanced. And so it made it similar to like the First World War, for instance, which had a similar dynamic, an advancement in technology, but the tactics were lagging. And it turned the war into an absolute bloodbath.
In fact, you give us the statistics of how many people died in that war, and it's just staggering.
Yeah, it really is.
My guest is Dylan Carroll, and he has written a book, Invisible Wounds, Mental Illness and Civil War Soldiers. And your book goes into, I mentioned earlier, history of medicine and what was going on with medicine at that time. You describe some of the misconceptions, if I want to label them that way, of what the practice of medicine, and what were the expectations at that time that doctors assume, this is the truth here. We have the truth here. And from our 21st century point of view, that wasn't the case at all.
And I'm glad to hear that the book, made you think. That's really great. That's kind of what I hoped, that it would kind of make people think. There was a number of things I was surprised by. And this is the challenge, but also the joy of researching and writing about the history of medicine, which is you have to really put yourself into the context of the time, because I think it's very easy for us to sort of sit back and look at the medical practices of the past and sort of think, wow, how stupid they were. I can't believe they thought that.
Dylan, I just imagine maybe a couple of decades from now, people will be saying, hey, you remember when we used to poison people and cut off parts of their body and we thought that was good medicine? So I feel that way now. Who knows what practices we accept today? Down the road, we'll learn, no, that's not the way it is. So, excuse me for interrupting, you were saying.
Oh, no, you're exactly right. And I think that was the point I was just going to make, is that it kind of makes you be humble a little bit, because you're right. In the future, people are going to look back at some of our practices and think, wow, they were idiots. Why were they doing that? So it really kind of humbles you and makes you, realize maybe how little or how much things will change in the future. Some of the stuff was really surprising. And, I was really tried to put myself into the context of the time, which especially when it comes to mental health care and their conceptions of mental illness were way different from ours. And I was surprised, you know, how orthodox many of them remained. You know, they had their ideas coming into the war, and it was kind of surprising how little the war altered their ideas. They basically stuck to their guns. And the ideas of mental health care and mental illness was essentially, they classified mental illness into two separate categories. There was mental illness caused by physical causes such as illness. They thought a severe disease could cause mental illness, a blow to the head, and accidents or something like that could cause mental illness. And then they classified another category, which was moral causes of mental illness. They thought that alcoholism, what they called intemperance, could cause mental illness. They thought, you know, immoral acts or immoral thoughts could cause mental illness. They classified syphilis, for instance, as sort of a moral cause of mental illness, even though it was really more of a physical one. And the war doesn't do that much to alter their views. They continue in the post-war period to kind of stick to their guns here with a little bit of variation and change. But it's not really until a new class of medical specialists, neurologists, kind of rise to challenge the status quo orthodox view of mental illness.
My guest is Dylan Carroll, and he has studied the period of time during the Civil War, and he covers the history of medicine, social history, military and institutional history. And we think of the Civil War, it's all about the military, but there's so many ramifications that we probably have never thought of until you bring these things up. And I was amused that something I didn't realize I was assuming, but when I was in grade school, and I grew up in Georgia, my family was living in Tennessee during the ancestors, during the Civil War, but there was an organization similar to the Daughters of the American Revolution called the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And when I was in grade school, they would sponsor an essay, and we were given a topic. And the one I remember was Nathan Bedford Forrest. And he was presented, we had to study up on him so we could sit down without notes and write an essay on Nathan Bedford Forrest. So for me, as a seventh grader, I was thinking, oh, we must be writing about him because he was some kind of hero. And your book disabused me of that right away. So who was Nathan Bedford Forrest?
Yeah, Forrest is such an interesting figure, both on his own right, but also the story you told, which is, you know, the United Daughters of the Confederacy really shaped, you know, 100 years almost of understanding of the Civil War, which was very pro-Southern because of their activism and their activities, such as, you know, essay writing. And it's in part the United Daughters of the Confederacy that really shape a sympathetic national narrative about the South, you know, that the South was just defending states' rights, which was not the case. They were defending slavery in actuality. And Forrest is one of these figures. He's before the war, he's a slaveholder, and he's actually, I believe that he's also a slave trader to some sense as well, and very much implicated in the system of slavery in the South, just like everyone, every white Southerner for the most part. But during the war, he's this ferocious fighter, and he's sort of, you know, legendary among Confederates as a very skilled fighter. But part of Forrest's participation in the war that's often forgotten intentionally or unintentionally is his involvement with the Fort Pillow Massacre, which was, yeah, a fort which included hundreds of African-American veteran or soldiers who were there. And Forrest and his soldiers capture the fort, and then they unleash an orgy of violence on the black soldiers there, killing hundreds of African-American soldiers at the fort in cold blood. and the survivors, you know, tell about forest troops shooting down defenseless Black soldiers, stabbing them with bayonets, executing them. And it's really a horrid scene. And Forrest is, you know, directly implicated in that.
So much of things like this that you tell in your book just make me stop and think, how could human beings treat other human beings that way? It's just heartbreaking. But one other note, I knew which company my great-grandfather fought in. And when I saw that he had fought at Fort Pillow, I thought, yay, it's not Nathan Bedford Forrest that's the hero. It's my great-grandfather. So he rose in my estimation. I really didn't know that much about him until after reading your book. And I went back to notes that I researched years ago myself. I thought, oh, yay, my great-grandfather fought against Nathan Bedford Forrest, or at least his company, his regiment did. And that was in 1864. So reading your book made me rethink a lot of things, assumptions, I guess, that I didn't even know I had. So,
Interesting.
One other thing that I never knew about Nathan Bedford Forrest, they certainly wouldn't have had us write it in the essay, and that was his connection to the Ku Klux Klan. I was horrified.
Right. Yeah. It's Forrest who, after the war, I think in Pulaski, Tennessee, starts the first Klan, which initially started as a veterans organization for Confederate veterans, and then quickly turns into I think it's fair to call it a terrorist organization that terrorizes Black Southerners, but not only Black Southerners, it terrorizes white Republicans in the South as well. Is, you know, really a pretty terrible organization that you know, metes out all sorts of violence and destruction in the South.
My guest is history instructor Dylan Carroll, and we're discussing his book, Invisible Wounds, Mental Illness and Civil War Soldiers. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Butte College history instructor Dylan Carroll, and he has written a book about the Civil War soldiers called Invisible Wounds. Dylan, if you don't mind, would you read the start of your chapter 4, How Soldiers Coped with the Trauma of War? Would you read us that part, please?
Of course. For many soldiers, the wide sweep of destruction the Civil War was inflicting on the bodies and minds of its participants could be traumatic. Both Billy Yank and Johnny Reb struggled with the emotional and psychological shockwaves of combat. Many of these personal struggles, however, have remained hidden from historians, in part because of the coping mechanisms Civil War soldiers employed. Not everyone who felt crushed by the weight of his emotions became a patient in an asylum. Many were able to short-circuit the downward emotional spiral of distress by a variety of management strategies. Soldiers were not merely passive victims of the war's mental trauma. Historians should question the narrative of victimhood that dominates the retelling of the Civil War, and instead investigate how soldiers successfully handled the stress of battle and remained relatively healthy and well-adjusted. To help bring themselves out of a mental tailspin, soldiers turned to religion, straggling, and camaraderie to self-soothe and mediate their stress. These can help explain how white Civil War soldiers were able to remain in the ranks for so long in such harsh mental, emotional, and physical conditions. Black soldiers, by contrast, largely found participation in the war itself to be a mediating influence on the perhaps greater trauma of slavery. The potential to meet their oppressors on the battlefield and run a bayonet through them could be a balm for nightmares of the lash. They could also exorcise the demons of slavery by liberating their friends and families, challenging the racism of their white comrades in the ranks and the white officers who commanded them, and attacking the symbols of oppression in the South.
My guest is Dylan Carroll, and he is reading from his book, Invisible Wounds, Mental Illness and Civil War Soldiers. And he's just been telling us some of the ways of reading in this section that the soldiers did cope. And one of them was religion. And how did religion help them cope? Because I was surprised at what religion led them to believe about themselves.
Yeah. I was really interested in, because I believed when I started this project that Civil War soldiers were able to cope, because so many of them write about the horrific experiences of battle, and many of them seem traumatized by their experience in the war, but so few ended up in asylums. And so my question was, you know, sort of how did that happen? What happens to for so many soldiers who seem traumatized for the war, but as far as we know, seem to live, you know, healthy and well-adjusted lives after it? And so I thought there was something going on here. When it comes to religion, what I found was, you know, many soldiers found the experience of battle and combat to be chaotic and disorienting. And they had gone into the conflict thinking that, you know, war would be ordered and that the courageous would be rewarded and the cowardly would be punished. And there would be this sort of order and there would be, you know, a greatness, kind of the awesomeness of serving in the war. But the reality is not the case. It's very chaotic. It's very disorienting. The courageous and the cowardly are punished alike. And oftentimes the courageous are punished more. And for many, it's this incredibly disorienting experience. And for some, like the example of James Williams in the book, you know, he is just sort of put into a mental tailspin after his experience at Shiloh. And he turns to religion, and religion for him, and especially this idea of kind of predestination, that God controls all events, for him helped explain the battle. I mean, he kind of turns to religion to say, essentially, you know, I survived because God wanted me to survive. And, you know, the battle in his eyes, once he viewed it from a religious lens, was not chaotic. You know, God was controlling every missile and every bullet, and he sort of saw God's hand on the battlefield and helped explain why people died and why people lived. And it turned what was once a chaotic and disorderly experience into one of order because, you know, God had ordained him living and others dying, and it helped him make sense of the experience.
So religion helped some of them cope. And then you mentioned straggling. And how did straggling help them cope?
Straggling was a 19th century term essentially for illegally leaving the lines. So you were essentially kind of going AWOL. And it was not uncommon at the time. A term they had for it, for instance, was taking a French leave, where soldiers would essentially leave the ranks for a few weeks and then come back. Straggling, you know, illegally leaving the lines for a short period, kind of essentially gave soldiers a break. And I have a remarkable example from a Maine soldier named John Jackson, who during the terrific Overland campaign, essentially straggles and leaves the lines for what turns out to be several months. And, you know, gets a break from combat and gets a break from the challenges of the campaign. And then, you know, returns basically happy and excited to go back to see the boys and participate in the campaign. And it's this sort of break that he carved out for himself that helped him cope with this experience. And he ends up at a hospital briefly. I don't know how he talked his way into a hospital, but he did. And, you know, he talks about, you know, marveling at how all the men there, you know, deal with the pain and suffering in different ways. And he writes about watching ships go back and forth on the Potomac. And it's this great kind of leisurely experience that he gives himself a little break and returns. And as far as we know, serves the rest of his time in uniform and is able to complete the campaign.
And elsewhere, you mentioned shirking, that's how some coped. So how could they shirk?
Shirk was kind of another synonym for straggling. So shirking was kind of also illegally leaving the front lines. You know, John Jackson's experience is not isolated. There's a whole bunch of other soldiers that tell us about the large numbers of soldiers that were straggling or shirking their duty, basically trying to illegally leave the front lines. And what's interesting is soldiers kind of seem to acknowledge it, and oftentimes they would protect each other. And so they recognized, you know, the crushing weight of service in the war. And there's a great example of a soldier named Rufus Dawes, who served essentially on a military board that was evaluating cases of shirking or straggling and deciding what to do and what punishment to level on soldiers who'd been caught. And they kind of had a system, essentially, where they would examine the soldier's prior record. And if they found that the soldier had been brave and had done his duty in good ways in the past, then they would shield that soldier from punishment, just sort of saying, you know, we think this guy is brave and a good soldier, and this was just, you know, an isolated moment. And so they kind of found ways to, you know, protect soldiers who they believe deserved protection. And so it, you know, kind of tells us that they were aware of this and aware of this phenomenon and finding ways to protect and punish soldiers who were caught shirking or straggling from the lines.
Well, you mentioned the camaraderie. And so one way of coping was they had each other. And I've heard this before about soldiers, like during the Vietnam War, they weren't fighting for God and country, but for their comrade next to them, their buddies, fellow soldiers. And you're saying that that's also how they coped during the Civil War.
That's right. Yeah. And I think to an extent, it was probably perhaps even more powerful in the Civil War, because unlike the Vietnam War, where men who volunteered or were drafted were thrown into units randomly with other men. In the Civil War, neighborhoods joined up together. So families and whole neighborhoods would be in the same unit together. And these were kind of local units that volunteered together. So oftentimes it would be boyhood friends, brothers, cousins, longtime neighbors who were all serving together in these units. And the real challenge and trauma of serving in the war kind of made them lean on each other. There's a really interesting phenomenon where, you know, understanding the soldier experience is one that can only really be understood through experience. You know, and there's examples of soldiers who were responding to their family's letters, who were basically writing saying, what was it like? You know, what was the experience of battle like? And the responses are often, you know, it's a hard question to answer. I can't exactly tell you what it was like. And there's a weird phenomenon where at points in the war, Union soldiers feel more camaraderie with Confederate soldiers than they do with Northern civilians, just because civilians cannot understand this experience. And, Confederate soldiers could, because they're fighting the same war. So it's this weird phenomenon. But yeah, they turn to each other. They find comfort in each other, and there's examples in the book about how units that had all sorts of class divisions before combat afterwards were totally united. You know, and one soldier, Oliver Norton, says that there was these class divisions in his unit. There was an aristocratic tent and tent of the upper 10. But after their experience in the 7 Days campaign in Virginia, they're all kind of dear friends, and there's this strong camaraderie between them. And soldiers write about how they would never leave their own regiment, and they wouldn't accept a place in any other. And they feel these extremely strong ties with their units. And as the war comes to an end, many of these veterans write during and later in their memoirs, write about how painful the separation was when the war ended, and they took leave of their comrades. And many of them admitted to, openly weeping as they took leave of their comrades for the last time, telling us how strong these connections had become.
Well, now that you mention it, many years ago when I wrote Washington for my great-grandfather's records, I also got his brother's records. And now that you're saying this, these two brothers were in the same regiment. And one was 22 when he was enlisted, and my grandfather, great-grandfather, was 19. And they served together. They were in a cavalry unit, volunteer, and they were literal brothers serving together. My guest is Dylan Carroll, and we're talking about his book, Invisible Wounds, Mental Illness and Civil War Soldiers. Now, another way, it's not exactly maybe how they coped, but you tell us how important it was for these soldiers to get letters from home. And you sought out some of these sources. You actually have the letters. What did you learn when you looked into that?
I mean, letters are everything to the soldiers. There is no Facebook, there is no Zoom in the 19th century. They can't see their family. For many of these men, they left home for the war, sometimes for the first time ever. Many of them had never been beyond 100 miles from their birthplace. And so, leaving home is itself kind of a traumatic experience for them. And letters become all important. It's their really only connection to home. And as home became sort of mythologized and came to kind of symbolize peace and civilization and happiness, letters from home became all the more important to the soldiers. And, soldiers write about, literally writing to their family saying, if I don't hear from you, I can hardly live. If I don't get more letters from you, I'm going to die. And people literally believed that. There was a medical condition recognized in the 19th century called nostalgia, which was essentially an extreme form of depression and homesickness. And
melancholy, too.
Melancholy, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Melancholy was the 19th century term for depression. But nostalgia was this recognized medical condition of basically extreme homesickness. And so they literally believed that they could die from homesickness, and letters were their only connection. And they required constant letters. They wrote to their family members constantly saying, write me more. Soldiers saved their favorite letters. There's some evidence of soldiers sleeping with their favorite letters, kind of treating them as talismans, almost like cuddling with them. And these were the symbols of home for them, and became incredibly important to them.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Dylan Carroll about his book, Invisible Wounds. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Dylan Carroll, who teaches history at Butte College and has written a book about mental illness and Civil War soldiers. A little bit ago, you mentioned how the experience of the Black soldiers differed from those of white soldiers, and they coped, the Black soldiers coped because they were fighting in an army to destroy the Institute of Slavery. That's what you tell us in the book. And I'll speak for myself. I feel quite ignorant of the Black soldiers' role and experience in this war. So I read this section and it brought to mind a movie, Glory, with Matthew Broderick. And other than that, we really have, don't have much idea of what it was like for Black soldiers. What did you learn that you might not have known?
Yeah, not many people know about the role Black soldiers played in the Civil War. I think the narrative of the Brothers' War, you know, of brother fighting brother, North versus South, kind of dominates. And, you know, the role of the African-American soldier is sort of subordinate to that, perhaps unfortunately, because I think it's quite an important and compelling part of the Civil War. I learned a lot about researching the experience of Black soldiers. It's very challenging because unlike white soldiers, we don't have nearly as many records or letters from African-American soldiers during the war, simply because the vast majority were former slaves. There was about 190,000 African-American soldiers, give or take. Maybe it was closer to 200,000. 146,000 of those were former slaves from the South. So the vast majority were former slaves that enlisted with the Army. And many of them, when they enlisted, were illiterate. They couldn't read or write. Some of them learned. Yeah, in many states, it's against the law to teach slaves to read and write. And in states where it was legal, it was often disapproved of. Frederick Douglass, you know, wrote about this in his memoir, about how his former enslaver's mistress, Sophia Ault, was teaching him to write. And her husband found out and disabused her of that and said, don't do this. This is a mistake. And so even in states where it was legal, it was disapproved of. And during the war, many former slaves eventually learned to read and write. But the records are a bit of a challenge. And so we have to turn to official records, memoirs, and then also white soldiers writing about African-American soldiers, which is can be challenging because you have to filter out the bias, which is ever present. But the war is radically different for African-American soldiers because they are fighting from the get-go to destroy the institution of slavery. That's their goal. For the North, that was a bit of a process, right? Northern soldiers, white soldiers in 1861 did not enlist explicitly to destroy slavery. The exigencies of war changed that over time to where by 1863, that does become the goal because the war was becoming so difficult to prosecute. But African-American soldiers from the get-go, they enlist to explicitly destroy the institution of slavery. And so this makes the war a different experience for them. Furthermore, unlike white soldiers who were perhaps captured by the Confederates and oftentimes, you know, became POWs and then sometimes would be exchanged and sent back north, that possibility was not on the table for African-American soldiers. The Confederacy had explicitly said, any Black soldiers we capture, we will either kill or re-enslave. And that was not an idle threat, as we talked about with Fort Pillow. The Confederates were ready to carry out that threat. And so, you know, the consequences of the war for African-American soldiers are different than for white soldiers. And, you know, many white soldiers write about African-American soldiers as just being ferocious fighters. And many of them, you know, are sort of like, I don't understand why African-American soldiers are fighting so hard. You know, we only fight if we have to, but Black soldiers, they're willing to fight constantly and all the time. I don't get it. And what they don't really get is that for African-American soldiers, again, this war is a war to destroy slavery. And they are, you know,
fighting or trying to fight their enslavers.
You tell a story of a guy who's sitting there next to his buddy. He's got a canteen of water. His buddy wants a drink. He hands him the canteen of water. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's Albert Franks, who was a German immigrant who landed in the United States in 1863 and then enlists, I think, the next year. Albert Franks was actually a pseudonym because he allegedly, he says, didn't want his mother to find out that he'd enlisted. He is Bermuda 100 in Virginia. They're digging a trench. He sits down and takes a drink of water. His buddy sits down next to him and he offers him a drink. And as his buddy's drinking from his canteen, a Confederate, force fires a artillery kind of feeler, as they say, just to give the Union force there a wake-up call. But unfortunately for Louis Beckhardt was his real name. Unfortunately for Louis Beckhardt's friend, that artillery blows his head off. And Louis Beckhardt sitting right next to his buddy, who's taking a drink from his canteen when that guy's is decapitated by this federal this Confederate artillery. He is obviously shocked by the experience. And in his retelling, in his pension case, he essentially describes what almost sounds like a psychotic break. He loses memory of shortly thereafter, and he wakes up essentially in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, which was the insane asylum in Washington, D.C., where all the Union soldiers were sent who became mentally ill. And his comrades remembered that he, at night, jumped out from the trench and charged at the Confederates, kind of saying he wanted to kill all the Confederates, and they had to restrain him. And he'd eventually just, he kind of had, like I said, what sounds like sort of a psychotic break of sorts, and ended up briefly mentally ill, although he did recover and, returned to private life.
Well, now, you just now mentioned pensions. And I had not read my great-grandfather's records carefully enough. And after I read your book, I read how much he got. And I thought $72 a month. I thought that's an awful lot back in those days. But it didn't start out that way. So here these veterans are going back and they fought and they can't get jobs. So how did this pension plan come about?
Right. Yeah. Pensions are an invaluable resource for any historian investigating Civil War soldiers and particularly Civil War veterans. And pensions came about in 1862. The federal government inaugurated legislation for a pension bill, and it was essentially trying to encourage enlistment because the war was going pretty bad for the North in 1862. And they wanted to encourage people to enlist. And so essentially they said, if you enlist, we'll offer you a pension. You'll get a payment after the war for your service. Like you said, initially pensions are pretty meager and low. I think the average or the starting pension for most privates was $8 a month. So it was pretty meager. But after the war, because mostly of politics, both parties kind of wanted to court the veteran vote. Both Republicans and Democrats wanted to court the veteran vote. And so pensions were increasingly raised, especially in the 1870s and 80s, as it was sort of a bipartisan point of agreement. And Civil War pensions were increasingly raised throughout the 1870s and 80s to try and court the veteran vote. And so they were really liberalized in the 1890s, where essentially anyone who had served 90 days, regardless if you had an injury or not, could get access to a pension. And they initially started as a way to support injured or disabled veterans in some sense. So if you'd had a debilitating illness or a gunshot wound or something like that, a pension would support you. But by the 1890s, if you'd served at all, you could get a pension.
Well, some of these veterans had trouble finding jobs because they were missing their hands. You talk about a guy who had both hands amputated, legs off, and that was fairly common, and arms. So they were limited in what kind of work they could do, even if they were willing, because of these amputations that they had to undergo. And we mentioned what happened to them when they came home. This was, say, the white soldiers. And then the black soldiers, what jobs were there for them? So a lot of them went out west, and you tell us that's where the term buffalo soldiers came from.
Yeah, many African-American veterans of the Civil War either remained in federal service or joined up later. And they were colloquially known as buffalo soldiers. And I don't think we know the exact origin of the term, but allegedly the story is that Native Americans thought that the dark curly hair of African-American soldiers resembled buffalo hair. And so Native Americans called them buffalo soldiers, allegedly.
Well, something else about after the war, because these medical schools, you talked about the history of medicine, and these medical schools didn't always have bodies for the students to study. And you tell us that black bodies were stolen and dissected in the name of science.
Yeah. Part of the story of this book is, looking at and examining the institution of medicine and how it was at the time sort of infected by racism. And before the Civil War, many states had prohibitions on corpse dissections because of, Judeo-Christian beliefs about the whole human body that needed to be buried right after birth, or right after death, I'm sorry. But medical students still needed and demanded this training, anatomical dissections. And so in states where there was a prohibition on cadaver dissections, many medical schools would surreptitiously get involved in grave robbing. And African-American, often cemeteries and communities, were the targets often of grave robbers because they were not as powerful politically or otherwise as white communities. And they could do very little to oppose grave robbing in their communities. And it's one example, I think, of many of, how racism was pretty common in medicine at the time, and explains, in part of the explanation for why, so few Black Civil War veterans ended up in insane asylums compared to white Civil War veterans.
Well, something that I guess rather surprised me was that the Civil War, the effects socially were really not that different. When Lincoln is assassinated, we get this President Johnson who's lenient on the Confederacy and on Confederates. And it seemed that it just on paper, maybe it looked like things were going to be different, but the reality was not that way.
Yeah, Reconstruction is kind of a, a bit of a tragic story that begins. And Reconstruction is the period right after the American Civil War, where the nation, literally and kind of figuratively reconstructs both America and also what it means to be an American. And the early years of Reconstruction are pretty optimistic and heady because, the world had literally changed. Slavery had been destroyed. But within 15 years, most of that progress had been rolled back, and the failure of Reconstruction inaugurates the period of Jim Crow, of racial discrimination and segregation. And, one of the characters in the book, Prince Rivers, his life kind of embodies this whole period. He's born a slave in South Carolina. He's one of the early African-American soldiers that joins what was then called Hunter's Regiment, named after David Hunter, that was briefly disbanded and then regrouped and became the 1st South Carolina. And he fights in some campaigns and is a really well known and popular. He goes on recruitment trips in the North to try and recruit support for emancipation and black soldiers. And then after the war, he's a prominent state official in South Carolina. But eventually the failure of Reconstruction and the inauguration of Jim Crow, ruins his advancement. Allegedly, according to his son, who remembered later, his property was essentially seized from him by white Southerners. And he was reduced to driving a carriage, which was the same work he'd done as a slave. And so it's really tragic, the course of his life. And he dies, he dies during Jim Crow, sort of having fought for the Civil War, seen slavery destroyed, and then also seen Jim Crow, this era of racial discrimination and segregation, inaugurated in the South.
Well, Dylan, I want to thank you for really opening our eyes to what war was really like. And we're faced with jobless veterans now. We're faced with people who are mentally ill and don't have a place to go. So I'm hoping that people will read your book and see the connections with what we cope with today. So thank you for writing this book, Dylan.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you liked it. And I hope that, I agree, I hope that people find it relevant and speaks to some issues today, which I think it does.
My guest has been Dylan Carroll, and he has written the book Invisible Wounds, Mental Illness and Civil War Soldiers. Thank you, Dylan.
Thank you.
Listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.